This is ExpertHR.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for ExpertHR.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. As the summer vacation season drew to a close, the National Labor Relations Board handed down a groundbreaking ruling that broadened the definition of joint employer. It's a ruling that could make it easier for unions to negotiate on behalf of workers at companies that rely on contractors and franchisees. On this podcast, we'll examine the NLRB's opinion in a case involving Browning Ferris Industries. Among other things, the NLRB said it will consider whether an employer has exercised control indirectly through a third party or whether it has reserved the right to do so. Joining us to make sense of this opinion is longtime Boston labor law attorney Howard Bloom, who practices with Jackson Lewis, where he represents employers. Howard, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here, David.
Well, we're glad to have you. And Howard, I'll begin with this. Why do you think there's been such an uproar over what the NLRB had to say in this case?
Well, here's why. The decision creates huge problems for the participants in a variety of business relationships, as you noted, including contractor, contractee, if that's a word, and franchisor, franchisee, and some other business relationships. In fact, two of the National Labor Relations Board members in Browning Ferris, the two who didn't agree with the decision, said that these business models will be fundamentally altered by the NLRB's new joint employer standard. Now, many companies contract with other companies, and let's call them for our purposes the user company and the supplier company. For the supplier company to have its employees do work at the user's facility. In Browning Ferris, for example, the supplier provided employees to the user who did a variety of tasks, including cleaning the user's facility. So let's say that the supplier company's employees decided they want a union. It used to be, in most cases, that if those employees ultimately brought in a union, it would be the supplier company that was solely responsible for negotiating the collective bargaining agreement and anything else that arose out of that union-employer relationship. Under Browning Ferris, in most situations now, the user is going to be considered a joint employer of those unionized employees along with the supplier employer, and as a result, the user employer is going to be jointly responsible for negotiating the collective bargaining agreement, for any unfair labor practices committed by the supplier, and subject to other kind of activity, labor activity, that it would not have been under the old standard. And under that old standard, the Labor Board required proof of a substantial amount of direct and immediate control by the user employer over the hiring, firing, discipline, and supervision of the employees of the supplier employer in order to make those two employers joint employers. Browning Ferris changed that completely, broadened the standard, and it allows a joint employer relationship to exist where not only is the control direct and immediate as it used to be, but it could be indirect or even reserved, meaning that the right to control is there even if it's never exercised.
So, Howard, if I'm a company like McDonald's or Subway or another that has tons of franchisees spread across the country, what does this mean for my organization?
Well, I can't comment on a specific company, of course, but I can say this. It's going to have an enormous impact on franchisors. Here's some background first to make sense of what I'll say afterwards. The National Labor Relations Act allows employers faced with union organizing by their employees to communicate with those employees the reasons why unionization might not be in their best interests. And employers regularly do this, and unions don't like it. Now let's get back to the franchisors. Let's say that the union wants to unionize a franchisee's employees, and the franchisee resists, as it has the right to. Before Browning Ferris, it may have been illegal for the union to picket the franchisor to get that franchisor to pressure the franchisee to not communicate to its employees its opposition to unionization, basically to give in to the union. However, after Browning Ferris, we can expect more public pressure, including picketing by unions against franchisors, to get them to turn up the pressure on the franchisees to agree to allow employees to unionize. Before Browning Ferris, doing that might have been illegal. After Browning Ferris, not illegal. And because of this now, expect unions to be empowered in their attempts to convince employees of franchisees to join the union, and expect there to be more union successors. And what does this mean? Well, if the union gets in, wins the union election at the franchisee, the franchisor, who is the joint employer, is responsible, along with the franchisee, for negotiating the collective bargaining agreement, for the unfair labor practices committed by any of the thousands of individual franchisees over whose employees they have little actual day-to-day control. This could trigger franchisors to say to their franchisees, hey, since we're going to be found to be a joint employer no matter what we do, because the standard is so easy to meet, we might as well act like one and set standards for hiring, firing, discipline, etc., essentially nullifying the independent business model. Or franchisors could go the other way by stripping down the language in franchise agreements to a bare minimum in an attempt to eliminate any semblance of control, or even by cutting ties altogether with local franchise owners.
Howard, with that said, do you think that this will create a lot of uncertainty for employers with this new standard?
Well, you know, I know that some commentators have said that it'll create a lot of uncertainty, and so my answer is a really good lawyer's answer, yes and no, but actually mostly no. Yes, in the sense that the NLRB has radically changed a well-established legal standard, so you know, it stands to reason that there will be some uncertainty among employers to see how it plays out as the NLRB issues decisions over the next several months applying the new standard to different business models. In Browning Ferris, the NLRB itself recognized that there will be some uncertainty. It indicated that it would apply the new standard on a case-by-case basis. And some uncertainty is also created by the NLRB's failure to identify all of the factors that constitute evidence of control. That being said, however, there is substantial certainty. Certainty that in most cases, the NLRB is going to find that a joint employer relationship exists and many of the factors that will result in a finding of joint employer. That certainty today allows employers to examine the relationships they have with companies and to determine whether they should terminate the relationship or alter it to gain more or less control. So what we know today is employers should take a look at the relationships, make a decision whether or not, based on their risk tolerance, they want to continue with the relationship as is or not at all.
Again, we're speaking with Boston labor law attorney Howard Bloom of Jackson Lewis. And Howard, I want to ask you about something that the NLRB said specifically in its opinion. The majority wrote, it is not the goal of joint employer law to guarantee the freedom of employers to insulate themselves from their legal responsibility to workers while maintaining control over the workplace, because such an approach has no basis in the National Labor Relations Act or in federal labor policy. What'd you make of that? Does the board have a point?
That was the NLRB's parting shot in its majority opinion, basically the last thing they wrote. You know, it's hard to disagree with such a broad statement. Of course, it's not the goal of joint employer law to allow employers to insulate themselves from legal responsibility to workers. Nobody's going to say that's the goal of joint employer law. But where I and my clients would disagree is in the NLRB's view of what constitutes maintaining control in the NLRB's statement. The NLRB's definition of control is overbroad, impractical, and ill-advised, and that is where disagreement with the NLRB's statement stems from.
And when you say it's overbroad, what do you mean by that? What makes the definition of control objectionable in your eyes?
Well, they talk in terms of reserved control. And reserved control is control that might be there but isn't exercised. They have taken every opportunity to cover every single possible control basis they can. And what this does is it makes it very difficult for employers to be comfortable having these relationships with companies. And it could end up with some of these companies going out of business. It could end up with some of them deciding we're not going to do this anymore and laying off employees and resulting in an increase in the unemployment rate.
Now, there are a growing number of contractors these days, the Uber lawsuits being a case in point, certainly. So do you think the NLRB majority had stories like that in mind with this opinion?
Absolutely. They say it. They say it up front. They cite facts and figures in support of the fact that the economy is changing. And they actually say that that is a reason why they needed to change the standard for joint employer. Now, I can't comment on Uber or any similar companies, any particular companies, but certainly the NLRB was concerned about that. And the problem is that, as the dissent says, you know, even if the NLRB's motivation for changing the standard is sound, its analysis was much too heavy-handed. And as a result, the potential for finding joint employer status is, as the two dissenters said, near limitless. Now, you know, it's very interesting to note, because I'll bet if we asked 100 people, what should the National Labor Relations Board base its decision on, and one of the choices, it was multiple choice, and one of the choices was the law, I would say that close to 100 out of 100 would say that basing it on the law is what the NLRB is supposed to do. But it seems like more and more, including in Browning-Ferris, the NLRB is basing decisions on factors beyond the law. Here, they say they're taking into account what they call the diversity of workplace arrangements, citing statistics, and admitting that that development is reason enough to revisit the joint employer standard. Now, they just recently, as you know, they decided this case involving Northwestern University, and in that case, they said we're not going to decide this case, but we reserve the right to decide it in the future if we think that the progress that the NCAA has made in treating these scholarship athletes better hasn't continued. And that's not a legal basis. That's an extra legal basis. So you've got it in Browning-Ferris, you have it in Northwestern. I think we'll continue to see those factors taken into account.
I'm sure a lot of our listeners are wondering, in hearing you speak, whether you think other agencies, and I'm thinking specifically of the EEOC, will follow the National Labor Relations Board's lead and expand their own definition of who qualifies as a joint employer.
Well, you know, obviously the Labor Board's decisions aren't binding on these other agencies, but for one, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission filed an amicus brief, friend of the court brief in Browning Ferris, seeking a broader joint employer standard. And OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, has indicated an interest in exploring the concept of joint employer relationships. The Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division is poised to follow the NLRB's lead. So the answer to your question is yes, I think we're going to see a liberalization throughout any number of agencies.
From a practical standpoint, Howard, how would this NLRB ruling change the advice that you would give to your clients?
Well, I think as a practical matter, when a client would call me before and they would ask me, do we have a joint employer relationship here? I would look at the standard then. It was an easy standard, direct and immediate control. But now I'm going to have to review their relationships and their contractual language and behavior based on not only direct control, but indirect control, and what I talked about before, this reserved potential to control. And because the potential for demonstrating control is so high, I'm going to advise employers to carefully assess their risk tolerance and determine if significant changes to their business model are both feasible and sustainable, because that's really going to be how they're going to get out from under the almost certainty that they'll be found to be a joint employer. We're going to have to examine their contractual relationships and determine if they can make modifications that will shield them from liability or at least best position them in the event of a joint employer challenge. And if they can't, I'm going to look them in the eye and say, what do you think about getting out of this relationship altogether?
So it sounds like from what you're saying that employers that contract with staffing agencies should perhaps reevaluate in their everyday relationships with the employees that they're provided from those agencies.
Absolutely need to do that and need to decide whether, if ultimately the relationship can't work, if it's watered down so much to try to evade or not be caught by the new joint employer standard, whether or not they want to go to a different model and just employ everybody themselves.
We only have a minute or so left, so before we go, Howard, is there anything else that you'd like to add or offer a final thought?
Well, I think there's a couple of things here. There's another case in the queue at the NLRB called Miller and Anderson, and that is related to Browning Ferris. In that case, the NLRB is going to evaluate whether to change the law in a situation where you have solely employed employees and jointly employed employees, whether they can be put together into the same bargaining unit to vote on a union without both of the employers consenting to that combined bargaining unit. Right now, consent is needed. In Miller and Anderson, I'm making a prediction the board will change it and say no consent will be needed and those employees can be put together in a single bargaining unit. And I think we're going to continue to see an activist labor board, and the next presidential election may or may not mean a new labor board and some of these changes overturned.
Certainly a lot to watch going forward, and it will be interesting to see how this Browning-Ferris ruling affects employers in the future. Howard, thanks so much for sharing your insights.
Thank you very much, David. Very nice to speak with you.
Again, Howard Bloom practices with Jackson Lewis in Boston, where he represents employers. I'm David Weisenfeld. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Continue checking our website for more programs on key employment topics affecting HR, including why social media policies are a bad idea and top telecommuting issues affecting employers. The opinions expressed in this program do not represent legal advice, nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about ExpertHR, our subscription offering, or our new 50-state employee handbook resource, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Again, that's 1-855-973-7847. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved.